Welcome to Rockin' the Music World. I'm Robert Lloyd.
Get on the left, get on the right. Turn on the radio and join in the fight. Sort out the lies, seek out the truth. On the radio, they're giving the proof. You're gonna love it, hate it, it can confuse. First time you try it, it can give you the blues. But take my word, you can call and abuse. Just keep on talking news.
Well, hello everybody, this is Robert Lloyd. Thanks for joining me today. I'm all excited about this show. It's all about music. And it's all about music by our people. I don't live in a Jewish world. I live in our own world with my people. And I'm tired of my people being blackballed from everything unless they are a total, disavow your own people, let them die off by the millions, and do the Jewish agenda. And no, that's not what this is about. The greatest musicians in the world, the greatest songwriters in the world, the greatest culture in the world is the white culture of Upper European ancestry, which I am of that. I'm of German ancestry, I've got English ancestry, but even that's Germanic, the Saxons. And it's just a beautiful day down here in South Florida where I live. It's the remnants of the hurricane out in the Atlantic that's striking the northeast of the United Socialist States of America is pummeling those those places, and it really, really saddens me. I just hate to see the largest Jewish city in the world get pummeled. That being New York City, of course, and I hate to see the socialist center of the world, Washington, D.C., and the surrounding communities, pummeled. I just hate to see that. And then, like, even the Wall Street closed down. I think the federal government closed down. Were we all lost during that 24 hours or 48 hours, however long they closed? I don't even know. I don't even care. The longer they're open, the worse they do. So who cares? You know, I'm an American without a country until Dixie rises again. Y'all know I have some Southern ancestry that I'm very proud of, and I have a great uncle, for instance, that died in North Georgia in 1863. He died in a Confederate hospital, Army hospital, and gave his life for the freedom of our people. And that doesn't matter if you're from the north or south, east or west. We're all freedom loving people that listening on this show anyway, and you understand every person from the north isn't a Yankee. Some people of the north came south and fought for the southern states, and we call those they were referred to many times as copperheads because they had a copper coin in their pockets, and they would take that coin out to see if the other person they would be talking to that day also had a copper coin. If they had a copper-headed coin, that meant they were both Southern sympathizers, and then they could talk freely to each other. Otherwise, you didn't dare at times. But anyway, we're here. It's rockin' the music world, and of course, I'm Robert Lloyd. And this week, we're going to have our program's going to be covering some of the few super magnificent songwriters of this world, and I'm proud to say I'm a songwriter. That's one of the main reasons I do this show. I want to give the beautiful culture that we have as a people that's disappearing, and we need to have it here in this network anyway. And I'm a songwriter, and I've been for the most part, banished from the music world. I mean, my ideology certainly doesn't set well with Jewish masters of the they own all the record labels. There's only three major record labels in the world. The Jews own them all. Well, one is I'm not even sure, Sony. It's run by some guy. He appears to be Irish, maybe. I don't know, and I'm not even sure his background. I can't find it per se. But basically, all the companies that are in Sony are headed by Jews. I mean, so even that one, if it's not the very top guy, Jewish, I mean, he's going to be as pro-Zionist in his manners as anybody would be. So anyway, I'm going to do a song today on the songwriters. And we write beautiful songs, and we have the most beautiful written songs the world's ever seen. I mean, we all know Beethoven, Pachelbel, Strauss, people such as that, Tchaikovsky. But we have some of these modern songwriters. You know, we have Stephen Foster in America back in the 1800s. Way down upon the Swanee River. He wrote a whole bunch. And I was going to have include him in this list today, but I decided not to because he's you know, from a century and a half ago or so, and I want to give him his own space there, and I'll have him on another show. Today I'm going to have some of the more modern songwriters, Kris Kristofferson, Andrew Lloyd Webber of Broadway and London. I'm going to cover Barry Gibb, who is one of the Bee Gees. He's the oldest Bee Gee, kind of the leader of the group, and one of the most successful songwriters in all of history. You didn't know that, did you? I'll be covering that. I'm going to be covering somebody who I'm not sure even belongs on the list, and we're going to discuss Woody Guthrie. This land is your land, this land is my land. But let's face it, Woody Guthrie was a socialist communist agitator for the Jews, and a poor excuse of a white man if we ever saw one. And I'm going to cover some of his songs, and you make your decision whether or not he's one of the great songwriters of all time, or is he just get more airplay and more positive press than other people would. Yeah, I'm going to be talking truthful on that. So that's just what I'm going to do. Don't ever think I'm going to lie to anybody. I might be mistaken on something and absolutely give a falsehood on this show. I could do that. Anybody could. I will not willingly ever do that. If I say something, it's because I truly believe it to be true, and in overwhelmingly most cases, I have enough to back me up on that I'm very confident of saying it right on the show, and I'm going to do it that way. They will just have to kill me to stop me, because I won't do it. And I know there's other people in this world that are speaking out too, and I'm proud to just be one of many, and we're not going to stop. We're going to be discussing Willie Nelson. Yeah, how about that? And then, of course, Hank Williams. You know, that's he's a story all in itself, and I should probably have a whole show just on Hank Williams. But he's going to be included today, and I still might have a whole show just on him. But let's talk about the songwriters. Conway Twitty once said, "It all starts with a song," and he was oh so right. With that in mind, I'm going to talk today about the great songwriters of music that give us where we all start in the process of having a hit song. It starts with the songwriter. And these are many times unknown people. And when you do recognize the names, a lot of times you recognize them as an artist, not realizing that the person is someone that writes the songs also. And it's very important that we understand this, because whether the person can sing and play the guitar, piano, whatever, that's fine and dandy. But I'm sorry, without the songwriter that writes the song. There's just notes in a key. That's all you're doing. You're playing jazz basically, which is that's a guy that can play a lot of notes in a measure and all the notes on his instrument in a certain key, but he has no place to go. So he just doodles around is all he does. He doesn't know the first thing about a beautiful melody or anything. That's the problem with jazz. I'm not saying all of jazz is like that. There's some things I like. I think a guy named Dave Grusin does so many jazz backdrops on movies that I really do like. He sets a tone, and I like stuff like that. But you don't listen to it like you do a great song. You don't want to hear anything else. You just want to hear that song. It's so good you have to hear it over and over. Jazz isn't like that normally. You might go to a bar and be bored out of your skull listening to it. Maybe that's what somebody likes to do. But anyway, back again to songwriting. We're going to be the various genres would be the classical, pop, rock, or country rock, which is my favorite. You might not like rock. You might not like country, but everybody likes country rock. We might even, one of these times, I'm going to have a show on commercial jingles. We all love our favorite music on jingles. You know, I remember back when I was a little bitty kid, 6-7 years old. I'll fly to the moon for a Lorna Doone. Remember that from Nabisco? It was on like Sky King shows, and I was just like 5 or 6 years old when that was on. But I just remember the jingles. My daughter is that way. Boy, she can remember every jingle, you know, every commercial. She would know them all, you know. And her daddy's just like that. I can tell you the great commercials. I just love a good commercial, not the slutty garbage stuff. But good commercials, not offensive, not loud and obnoxious, you know. But I'll have a show on that coming up too, and I just love that. You'll get a kick out of it because you'll recognize all these. We all do from TV and radio and stuff. But today we're going to concentrate more on the traditional music, the venues being, you know, country, rock, pop, popular music, things, even classical. Although we're not going to have too much classical here, but Andrew Lloyd Webber is borders on classical at times, and I'm gonna cover some of his songs that you will recognize and really like. Let's start off with Kris Kristofferson.
Don't look so sad. I know it's over, but life goes on, and this old world will keep on turning. Let's just be glad we had some time to spend together. There's no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head upon my pillow. Hold your warm and tender body close to mine.
Born June 22nd, 1936, in Brownsville, Texas, which he would now, today, never be born in Brownsville, Texas, because Brownsville, Texas is right on the Mexican border, and there's hardly a white person there. So, Kris, welcome to your hometown, but why don't you stand up and have some guts and admit your city's gone. You know, but anyway, he's still alive today. Of course, you see him on movies and TV and stuff. As he's kind of abandoned his songwriting. It's a strange thing. He was a son of a military officer, And when the United States Air Force was finally created, his dad became a major general. Yes. Christofferson is considered equal part intellectual and an athlete growing up. He was award-winning short story writer as well as a Golden Gloves boxer. He graduated from Pomona College in 1958 with a degree in creative writing and went on to attend Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. While in England, he performed under the name Chris Carson. Oh, that's... He was never satisfied with their names, I guess, playing country and folk music. After leaving Oxford, Christofferson joined the United States Army in 1960. He served as a helicopter pilot in Germany. Imagine that. Now, about that helicopter pilot stuff, I'll tell you about his relationship with Johnny Cash and how that came in handy. While he was in the Army, he rose to the rank of a captain, pretty good. And he also turned down the chance to have a teaching position at West Point. And he just said no. He wanted to pursue his dream of becoming a successful songwriter. And he eventually got out of the service. And it caused such a stir in his family. They say he has never been forgiven. His family has such an honored tradition of being in the services of the United States that when he did this, his mom and dad virtually disowned him. Seems a little tough. Before we go any further, I want to tell you a story. This happened just yesterday. Okay. I'm having trouble with some things on my computer. I'm getting a new computer here this week. Some recording equipment I've got to change out and everything, and so that's going to be real exciting and everything. But I needed to get a piece that malfunctioned in my system. I had to go over to Radio Shack, which isn't very far away here in South Florida, and drove over there last night. Told the young man there, there were several clerks, one young Hispanic guy, probably under 25, I would guess, waited on me. Nice guy. Found me exact replacement part for it, so I'm checking out, and I've got my Nebraska Cornhuskers T-shirt on. And he looks at me and he goes, "Wow, I like your quarterback." I said, "Taylor Martinez, huh?" "Yeah, I like a little brown in my quarterbacks." So, wait till you hear this, folks. Okay, now I'm a Nebraska expert. That's my football team. I love the Cornhuskers and what they represent. I looked at the young man, and he just blazingly said, "I like a little brown in my quarterbacks." And he was a big fan of Taylor Martinez, who's a great quarterback, a junior in college right now. We'll have him this year and next year in Nebraska. And while we were talking, black guy walked up and standing right next to me. He was looking at something in the counter, and I'm talking to this young Hispanic man. I looked at him. I says, "Well, I got a story to tell you." He says, "Oh, really? What's that?" Let me tell you about who Taylor Martinez is. Taylor Martinez's dad. His mom and dad divorced very early in his life, and his mother married a man named Martinez. And early in his life, then he took the name Martinez, and he used that throughout his life. He got married, had several children, one by the name of Taylor. So Taylor's last name is Martinez. I said, "But Taylor Martinez's ancestry is German-English, just like yours truly." And he's got this, he's almost turning white now, right? And I'm just joking with him and laughing along, and this black guy's staring at me like, "Well, you can't make statements like this because you're not a black or Hispanic or whatever." And I'm just enjoying this. I says, "Yep." And I like Taylor Martinez. When I found out he was a white German English ancestry, I'm white German English ancestry, and I liked him even more for that reason. And the guy just looks at me and says, "Okay, you got me." I says, "But I still like Taylor Martinez." I said, "Well, you should if you liked him, you know. But, you know, fair's fair, right?" And he says, yeah, yeah. So that's my story of the week. It was a classic. Anyway, back to Kris Kristofferson. So he gets out and wants to be a songwriter. So he goes to Nashville, and he just finds odd jobs and stuff, and finally gets a janitor's position in one of the record labels, Columbia Records. He's working the night shift, digging out the garbage, cleaning the floors, mopping everything up, and he's a Rhodes Scholar, folks. But this is beautiful. This is how you know the guy's smart. He's a songwriter. What do? You got to get your foot in the door. Something I didn't do. I sat there in the Midwest, confused about what should be going on. And yet Kris Kristofferson did the right thing. Get to Nashville. Get a job. Get a job as a janitor in a record label if you have to. So anyway, one day, who was it? Who was it? There was a good songwriter. I think it was Bob Dylan was recording in Nashville one time, and Kris Kristofferson was, of course, janitor in that building at the time. And he wanted to go up to Bob Dylan and tell him he was a songwriter and he wanted him to review some of his songs. But he said he couldn't. He was in fear of losing his job. I guess they have it probably. It's so prevalent in Nashville that if you do that, you're going to get fired, because otherwise every clerk, every accountant, everybody would be hitting on all the recording artists coming into the studios to record. So I understand that, but this really added to a dilemma for Kris Kristofferson. Here's a major artist that he would like to get some songs to, even though Dylan was a songwriter. He finally started making contacts, and he wrote Me and Bobby McGee, and of course, that was a hit for Janis Joplin. Remember that? I'll play it for you here. And Roger Miller was the first to record it. Roger Miller was a songwriter who wrote 400 songs, almost 399 or 400 songs. He's the guy that never co-wrote with anybody. Remember, he wrote "Dang Me, Dang Me, You'll Take a Rope and Hang Me, Tie Me to the Highest Tree." Woman, won't you wait for me? Boop, 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 boop. Remember that? And he also did Trailers for Sale or Rent. He did a lot of those songs, and he was considered one of the best songwriters in Nashville. And he never co-wrote. And his publishers say, "Why don't you co-write with a couple of these other people? We'll give you some other people to work with." He said, "Did Picasso co-paint?" So anyway, he didn't co-write. I remember another time with Roger Miller. He gave a song to his publisher, and the song only had four lines. And his publisher looks at him. Of course, Roger Miller's a big star by this time, and he gives his publisher four lines. Where's the rest of the song? And Roger Miller goes, "That's it. That's all it needs. That's it." Now, I don't remember what song that was, but I just love that. I just, you know, songwriters are odd people at times, and the best songwriters are just absolutely truthful. I mean, you just, that's all I have, and that's all I want the song to have is four lines, and that's it. So, I mean, there's not much you can do with talking them out of that. So, anyway, he also got a song to Johnny Cash. Sunday Morning Coming Down. You remember that song? It was one of Johnny Cash's biggest. He didn't write it. Kris Kristofferson wrote it. And as I understand, I remember this for 20 years, 25 years ago when I heard this. Being a helicopter pilot, Kris Kristofferson got a helicopter. And he placed the helicopter down in Johnny Cash's backyard and told Johnny, "I've got a song for you." And that was Sunday Morning Coming Down. He thought it was going to be great for Johnny Cash. He wanted to get that to Johnny Cash, so that's what he did. And they became very good friends. And I, you know, as somebody in the music industry, if somebody laid down a a helicopter in my backyard. I mean, I'd be tickled pink. I'd give the guy the time of day. I mean, if he's done that, okay, give me your song. Let me listen to it. You know, it takes all kinds. He was popular with the fans, but the critics also loved him too. And I think critics liked him because he was a scholar. You know, so they have something that they can say, oh yeah, he's a good writer because he's a Rhodes Scholar. Well, I'm sorry. Most Rhodes Scholars have never written a song. So what does that tell you? It has nothing to do with being a great songwriter. It just happens to be the case. It's like saying, oh, he's a helicopter pilot. Helicopter pilots write great songs. No, it's just stupid. But that, you know, but journalists, I mean, they're going to at least, and critics are going to have to say, oh yeah, he's a great writer because he's a Rhodes Scholar. Well, in spite of being a Rhodes Scholar, he's a great writer. He's an odd sort. He actually wanted to be like a novelist. He got in the movies, and it's like he has spent more of his time doing that than he has songwriting, and yet he's come up with so many beautiful ones. Help Me Make It Through the Night, For the Good Times. I mean, we're talking some of the greatest songs in all of country music. Help It Make It Through the Night by Sammy Smith, who's one of the classiest.
Take the ribbon from my hair, shake it loose and let it fall, playing soft against your skin like the shadows on the wall.
Come and lay down. Recordings ever made in country, as was For the Good Times, sung by Ray Price. And what a gorgeous production that is, with all the strings and everything. Of course, you'll hear it today in this. He was inducted, Kris Kristofferson was inducted in the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2004. And I'm going to leave it there, folks. I should probably do a whole show just on him, because he is a character, and that's where it is. I'm going to be hard-pressed to get too many of these people in today. My next on the list here is Andrew Lloyd Webber, not country, of course. Now we're into beautiful stuff from Broadway and the London Theater.
Midnight, not a sound from the pavement, as the moon lost her memory, she is smiling alone. In the lamplight, the withered leaves collect at my feet, and the wind begins to moan. Memory, all alone in the moonlight, I can smile at the old days. I was beautiful then.
He's English. He was born in London in 1948. He's alive and kicking these days and very successful. His father was a director of the London College of Music. Well, there's your end, folks. His mother was a piano teacher, and his younger brother, Julian, is a renowned cellist. So, you know, is that make Andrew Lloyd Webber music in his blood? I don't know. I mean, I've got musicians in my family all over the place, but no, I don't know if you inherit this type of thing, you know, or does it skip generations? I don't know. I don't know. You could argue the point all day long, and I could hear various sides of that. He was a child prodigy when he played the piano early in life, and he could play the violin at age 3 and the French horn, and then he began writing his own music. Well, if my mom and dad would have had me on the piano at 3 years of age, I would have been writing music too, because as soon as I could have an instrument of any type, and I had to basically almost steal an instrument to have one to play, because I didn't get any help family-wise. It's a long story, folks. And I just always have been a writer, and they're saying Lloyd Webber was too. And I do think Andrew Lloyd Webber is easily the second best Lloyd in the music business. And I'll leave it at that. Happy for the guy. He doesn't write lyrics, and he's incapable of writing lyrics, kind of like an Elton John who doesn't write lyrics. And they say Lloyd Webber is a terrible, terrible person to work with. Lyricists have fits with the guy, and it's interesting to me that he's not a lyricist, and yet he's criticizing lyricists. So I don't know about that. Now they've been successful. He's written with several people. Tim Rice is the most famous of his people he's written with, and the bulk of his stuff that you might know. He's done the musical Cats, Evita, and the Phantom of the Opera, and he's got every honor, including knighthood, which as an American, I could care less. 7 Tony Awards, 3 Grammy Awards, an Academy Award, and I don't know what award, and the Kennedy Center Honors Award. Well, how about that? Was 17 years old. Lloyd Webber was getting to be pretty well known, and he received a letter from a 21-year-old law student by the name of Tim Rice. It read in full, "Dearest Andrew, I've been told you're looking for a with it writer of lyrics for your songs. And as I've been writing pop songs for a while and particularly enjoy writing the lyrics, I wonder if you consider it worth your while meeting me." Signed, Tim Rice. Well, they found a collaborative team together, and they worked for each other for a long time. They did Jesus Christ Superstar in 1971, for instance. And I'm not a real fan of that. Being a Baptist, I am. Being a, there was things in there that just aren't right. And of course, the Jewish run Broadway would all be for that stuff, of course. And other things he had written, Evita was a concept they came up with in 1976, and it's just a singing type of play, and I don't like musicals like that. I like music within a play. You know, somebody will sing something, and then they go back into their exchange, you know, like a regular movie. If you're going to sing the whole thing, I just think that's stupid. And so, but anyway, within the song, play Evita was "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina." And folks, that's one of the most beautiful songs written in the 20th century. It's just gorgeous. They all wrote later than that. They came up with an 86 Phantom of the Opera, and has gone on to become the longest running Broadway show in history. It celebrated its 10,000th performance on Broadway on February 11th, 2012. Now, isn't that interesting? I couldn't do my show without telling you it was February 11th. Okay. Anyway, that's Andrew Lloyd Webber. We should probably do a whole show just on him, too. Next up is Barry Gibb with the Bee Gees. Brothers Gibbs, yeah, the Brothers Gibb is what the BG stands for. Born September 1946, a musician, singer, songwriter, and producer. He was the founding member of the Bee Gees, being the oldest brother. And he's actually the last surviving member, unfortunately, folks. He also shares a record with John Lennon and Paul McCartney for consecutive Billboard Hot 100 number ones as a writer with six. He had six in a row. Can you imagine that? The book of the Guinness World Records lists Barry Gibb, there's no S on it, as the second most successful songwriter in history behind Paul McCartney. Gibb had a highly successful career as a member of the Bee Gees, obviously, a group near the top of the all-time top sellers list. And only Elvis Presley, the Beatles, Michael Jackson, Garth Brooks, and Paul McCartney have outsold the Bee Gees. So the Bee Gees are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They are sixth. And, of course, the Beatles and Paul McCartney are actually, in a sense, one and the same. Anyway, it was interesting how they're one of these groups and artists that reinvents themselves. You know, during the 60s, they were in the Beatles vein, the Beatles genre. And then that started coming into an end, as we all know. In the 70s, disco came in. Guess what? The Bee Gees reinvented themselves as a as the soundtrack contributors to Saturday Night Fever. All of a sudden, they were disco guys. And Saturday Night Fever, you know, and they have 16 Grammy nominations and 9 Grammy wins. They are the only pop group in history to write, produce, and record 6 straight number one hits. Of course, Gibb is a prolific and successful songwriter. In 1977, here's something here. Gibb saw 5 of his songs simultaneously enter the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100. And for 1 week in March, 4 of the top 5 songs were written by him. Woo! His songs were number one for 27 out of 37 weeks from the 24th of December 1977 till 2nd September 1978. Now that's interesting. As a songwriter, Gibb has had number one songs in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. When Islands in the Stream became number one in the UK as a comic relief single in 2009, they did a version of that in England. You know how the English are always kind of crazy like that. Anyway, that's what I have on Barry Gibb. I could do a whole show, of course, on the Bee Gees, and probably will. I will probably do it. My next artist up here I'm going to talk about is Woody Guthrie.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway,
Woody Guthrie wrote more than 1,000 songs. Well, so have I. But I like to hear that because, well, you know, I know I meet so many people in my life that they're songwriters. And I always say this, everybody's a songwriter, but there are very few songwriters. And I've always said that, and I truly believe it. There's only very few songwriters. I've run into so many guys and gals that are really hot on writing songs, and I'll ask them, well, how many songs have you written? I'm always curious about that. And it seems so many times I get the response, 30. I don't know what it is about 30 songs, but there's a lot of people in this world that have 30 songs that they've written. And then it just tails off after that. And then you'll find, you'll find lyricists, for instance. If you ask them how many songs they've written, and they'll say, 5,270,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, put the music. And then it's part of a song. But, you know, when I say, how many songs have you written? I mean, I don't want to hear how many four lines of poetry have you written. I mean, there's more to it than that. And you know, when Barry Gibb, when he said he had written over 1,000, I mean, you know, or how many he has, I guess Woody Guthrie here says 1,000. So, including So Long, Union Maid, he's, of course, that came up with, "This land is your land, this land is my land." And that's a decent song, but I mean, it's a song, but, you know, I'm going to play a few of his other songs here, and you tell me, are these great songs?
Take me riding in the car, take me riding in the car, take you riding in my car, I'll take you riding in my car. Click, clank, open up the door, girl.
Or are they not great songs? And why is he considered so great? And why does he get such positive press? Because he's a socialist. He was a communist. That's what he spent his life doing. And, you know, he was a troublemaker. You can idolize the guy all you want, but communism is the ultimate form of slavery. Let me die, but I don't want to be, you know, I'd rather be dead than red type thing. I'm a believer in, the government is at its best, which is never, but it is at its best, relatively speaking, when it is as small as it gets, and communism is total government. So anyway, so here's, you know, this guy, Woody Guthrie, born 1912 in Oklahoma. He was just after Woodrow Wilson was nominated as a Democratic candidate for presidency. Even in this, I found on this guy, they even you know, match him up to Democratic presidents and stuff like that. And he said, for instance, he told a crowd one time, "My father was a hard, fist-fighting Woodrow Wilson Democrat. So Woodrow Wilson was my name, so his name was Woody Woodrow Wilson Guthrie." Okay, fine and dandy, but call me Robert George Patton Lloyd then. I mean, I don't care. I mean, that's what I want. Or call me Robert E. Lee Lloyd. I mean, you know, choose your poison, folks, but I want to be named after somebody that I would really, really admire. And both of his parents were musically inclined, and they taught Woody a lot of songs when he was young, how to play the guitar and harmonica. And he had tragedy and personal loss early in his life, throughout his childhood, and it's just the way things go with his family. I mean, a lot of us have experienced things like that. I lost my mother here this past year. And I hadn't seen her for 20 years. It's tough. We all have things in our lives, and just because a person's famous doesn't mean they have harder times than a person that's not famous. Some of the people listening to this right now have had many tragedies in your life, and you've had to pick yourself up off the ground and move forward. And we all have to do that. He got married when he was 19. And, you know, that didn't work out. Let me say it here. And, they went through the Great Depression, and it hit his family hard, and drought stricken Great Plains, and the infamous Dust Bowl. Well, my parents went, my grandparents and parents went through that stuff too. And in 1935, his family migrated west, the thousands of Okies that went out in search of work. And Guthrie abandoned his family at times, and he spent his time hitchhiking, riding freight trains, and he could quite literally, it says, sing for his supper. With a guitar and harmonica, Guthrie sang in the hobo and migrant camps, developing into a musical spokesman for labor and other left-wing causes. Folks, left-wing just means you have communist sympathies. You're for the enslavement of mankind. I mean, that's all you're talking. You know, wear your Che Guevara T-shirt with his negative black-faced with his a cap on there and his curly hair and oh, you're proud to be Che Guevara. You know, I'm sorry that the guy was a slaver. That's all he is. You know, he's the lowest of the lows. He's everything that I will fight to the very end against. They attribute these left-wing causes of the bedrock for Guthrie songs and stories. And of course, it was. And then in 1940, they had the autobiography Bound for Glory. And they went to New York City, which, of course, guess who's at in New York City? The Semites there. He became a popular guy with This Land Is Your Land, and they call it an alternative national anthem. Well, it's not my national anthem, I'll guarantee that. During World War II, he joined the Merchant Marine and began composing music with a more strident anti-fascist message. Well, of course he did. He's a communist. He was famous, or I'll say infamous, for performing with the slogan, "This machine kills fascist," scrawled across his acoustic guitar. Well, I'm going to scrawl across my guitar, "This machine kills communist," and they'll arrest me. You watch. Anyway, it's hilarious. He got out and got remarried out of the Merchant Marine when the war was over. And made his home in Coney Island, New York. He had four children, with Arlo being one of them. Remember Arlo Guthrie? I remember that oh so well. "You can do anything you want at Alice's Restaurant." Remember that? And he was considered musically prolific. Well, you know, I listened to a lot of his songs. I forced myself. And most of them are just crummy. Simplistic, crummy. And, you know, finally, after he's getting all the pats on the back, and his health started to deteriorate in the late 1950s. He was hospitalized for a long time, and he finally died in 1967. And his marriage collapsed during the last years of his life. And his second wife that had already left him and his children would visit him in the hospital regularly. And, you know, as would Bob Dylan come in, of course. Dylan moved to New York City from Minnesota. Bob Zimmerman. And, you know, he would seek out his idol. And Guthrie warmed up to the young singer, he would later say. Anyway, that's, I guess he had Huntington's chorea. He died from complications from that. And I don't know much about the disease, but knowing his background, I don't know. We'll see what happens. Anyway, that's what we have for that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Willie Nelson. I need a lot more time than this to cover.
In twilight glow I see blue eyes crying in the rain.
Willie Nelson, born 1933 in Abbott, Texas, grew up in the in a poor family. He was raised by his grandparents, I think, if I remember right, something like that. He grew up singing in church. He was a local local hero because he could sing pretty good locally. But you know, if you listen to Willie Nelson, he's not a real fine vocalist. Usually he sings his own songs like Crazy. Crazy would never have been a hit song if he was the one that was singing it. It took a Patsy Cline to do it right. Anyway, he became part of the outlaw movement with Waylon Jennings in the 1970s. And after he got out of a suit and tie and stopped being a stand-up singer, which it was never going to happen, it never did, he was a failure. Finally, even though he was a great songwriter, they accepted him with the long braided hair and the outrageous, you know, turning his back on society. And he went down into Texas with the outlaw gang, and that's what they did, and he became very famous and beloved after that. Singer, songwriter, actor, philanthropist. He has written, they say, about 2,500 songs, and he has released close to 300 albums. No, I'm sorry. Okay, cookie-cutter stuff then. He's recognized worldwide as an American troubadour. His sister plays piano in his group. They're very close. He's always in the farm aid thing. He's for legalization of hemp. They were raised by their paternal grandparents during the Great Depression, him and his sister Bobby. She's an older sister. And they attended the Methodist church in the small town, and they were exposed to all the hymns, and that's where Willie learned all that stuff, and his sister. And I remember the first song, he sold a song for $50 to his guitar teacher. I don't know what happened to that one, but he gave a song to a publisher in Nashville when he was a nobody, of course. He got $50, and the song became a hit. But the thing is, for $50, the publishers put their own names on it. There's two guys' names on it. I don't know what the song was. I can't remember. And so here it was up there in the top of the charts. I don't know if it got number four or wherever it got. And Willie's name was nowhere to be seen. Normally on your hit charts, they give you the songwriters of the songs along with the artist. Nothing about Willie Nelson. And most people would have been heartbroken on that. But Willie looked inward to himself and said, "Look it, now I know I can write a hit song." And so he's done some great stuff. Nightlife, Crazy.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Funny how time slips away. And remember Farron Young's "Hello Walls, Hello, Hello." That's a Willie Nelson song. So he's he was great, and of course was responsible for Patsy Cline's rise in the music world. You know, one of them, Harlan Howard being another one, and a lot of other good songwriters. But I don't have a lot of time, so I have to kind of move on. With that one, I need to do a whole show on Willie Nelson. Of course, Willie's still in the business. He's getting pretty old now, but he's doing good, and more power to him. He's gotten in trouble with all sorts of things in his life, and still is alive and kicking. The next one I'm going to talk very shortly about, and I need to do a whole show on him too, is Hank Williams.
Try to sleep.
He was born in 1923 in Mount Olive, Alabama. Considered one of the more popular of all-time American country music singers and songwriters, songs like Cold, Cold Heart, your cheating heart. Hey, good looking. And I'll never get out of this world alive. So, he died of a heart attack at the age of 29 in 1953 in the back seat of a Cadillac. Williams was the third child of Lon and Lily Williams, who grew up in a household that never had much money.
Did you hear that lonesome pepper will? It sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is wild. And I'm so lonesome I could cry.
His father worked as a logger before the entering the Veterans Administration Hospital. When young Hank was just six, his father and son rarely saw each other over the next decade, with William's mother, who ran a rooming house, moving the family to Greenville and later to Montgomery, Alabama. His childhood was shaped by his spinal condition, spina bifida, which set him apart from other kids his age, and it made him kind of have a sense of what they say separateness. You know, he just didn't fit in. And he started a career very early with a guitar at the age of 8 and singing everywhere he could. And by the age of 13, he made a radio debut. And later was entering a talent show, and he had his own band at Hank Williams and the Drifting Cowboys, which, of course, is a famous band. In full support of her little son's musical aspirations, his mother, Lily, drove him and his band to shows throughout southern Alabama. And by the 1940s, he caught the attention of music executives in Nashville. That is because Hank Williams had charisma. He never would have made it in today's world. He's not, you know, he's a skinny, frail-looking guy, isn't soap opera good-looking. He's a wild man, didn't care about anything, might come drunk when he played. But he was just a wild guy and just enjoyed singing, and he would not have been somebody that, you know, Nashville would have wanted today. And he had his first hit, Moving All Over, Moving All Over. Remember that song? And then he had a second one on the Billboard in 1948, was Honky Tonkin'. Remember that song? But he had erratic behavior on and on with his drinking, and he'd go in the live performances drunk if he even showed up. Finally, the Louisiana Hayride would ban him, as did the Grand Ole Opry, and then they'd hire him back. And I remember the guy at the Louisiana Hayride said, you're not coming on this show anymore. And he'd say, yeah, well, you're not going to get more people to come to your hayride. And that was the way it went. So they'd always have to let him perform. But he's a very, very interesting guy, as is his son, Hank Jr. Absolute. I have some things about that I would like to say, but we're running out of time here, so I'm going to have to let it go. Again, he died in the back of his Cadillac. At 5:30 in the morning, his chauffeur that was driving him to West Virginia pulled over, and he looked in the back, and he looked pretty bad, so he shook him, and he was dead. He just he died in his back seat all alone, and that's just the way it was. That's Hank Williams Sr., folks, and this is Rockin' the Music World with Robert Lloyd. I love you, folks. Thanks for tuning in, and hope to see you soon. On the next show, I don't know what it's going to be yet. If you have any songs, send them in to me. My email's there on the website. And love to hear any songs you have. I'll probably have a show on our songwriters that listen to this show. God bless. This is Robert Lloyd. And take care. Every morning.